So we're getting ready to start chapter 26 in Matthew. Been working our way through Matthew's gospel. And actually the first couple verses give us a good review. So I'm just going to go right to them. When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." So the first part of that, when Jesus had finished, is that phrase that's identical in the Greek text that's repeated every time one of those discourses that Jesus gave. Matthew formed his whole or outlined his whole book around these discourses of Jesus, collections of Jesus' sayings. And we've looked at this before, but this is where we've been. And started out with the Sermon on the Mount, then the instructions to the apostles that were newly commissioned, the parables of the kingdom, the instructions to the church, and then finally the Olivet Discourse, the return of the king. Each of the bolded areas is how that same phrase is translated, but it's an identical phrase. So it lets us know that something is coming to a completion. Now the word "all" becomes important here because now all the discourses are finished. Chapters 24 and 25, the Olivet Discourse, were the last major recorded sections of Jesus' teaching. Not that he won't have some more things to say that we need to take to heart, but this has been what Matthew's been doing. Now Luke and Mark both go right to, or John and Mark both go right to this plot by the Pharisees, the leaders. We're going to read about it in a minute. But Matthew adds this next little section. He said to his disciples that after 2 days the Passover is coming and the Son of Man will be delivered to be crucified. So that's kind of his recap or reminder of another thing that's repeated throughout Matthew and the other Gospels, which are three points at which Jesus predicted his death. His arrest, his death. They started out in chapter 16 with a pretty generic one. Not a lot of detail there. Then in 17, we got the idea that this is going to be something, it'll be handed over to the hands of men, and what's going to happen will be at the hands of men. Be killed, raised on the third day. And in chapter 20, we got the most detailed of these predictions. Going to Jerusalem, that's where they are now. Delivered to the chief priests. Condemned to death, then delivered to the Gentiles, or handed over to the Gentiles, mocked, flogged, crucified. And so now he reminds, really, his disciples who have heard these things, us as readers of this gospel, hopefully remember these things, that this is what's about to happen. This is where we're going to go. So from here, we get into the chapters that really, chapter 26, 27, that have to do with the Last Supper, the arrest, the trials of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus, all this suffering that he's going to go through now for the next couple of chapters. And like most of the Gospels, this is where most of the detail is. More time is spent on these couple of days than on any period of time in the Gospels before, and that's true of all of them. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar by the people." The sense of the first word here is that this was maybe probably going on at exactly the same time that Jesus made this prediction. He said it's going to be in 2 days. Mark tells us that this meeting by the leaders of the Jewish people was 2 days before as well. So these things are kind of some parallel events that are going on. Jesus talking about what's going to happen, where we've come, the learning, what we've learned so far. And then this plot, really, by these Jewish leaders who were so offended by Jesus and so against him and all through his ministry. It's kind of an ominous warning, but now it's only 2 days away, this crucifixion. There's only one thing on the agenda for these people's meeting, and it was, how do we arrest Jesus without causing a public uproar? Is the first thing. And that is, okay, that problem was there were lots of people in Jerusalem for the Passover, a lot of people from Galilee who considered him a prophet, perhaps the Messiah. They didn't want to have a riot. Now, this was the Passover, that time period, that celebration when the Jews celebrated their deliverance from Egypt, was a festival that was held every year. The population of Jerusalem swelled during this time as people came to this thing. And there was a lot of tension, a lot of problems actually leading up to this, had been for decades, where it was not unusual to have some sort of disturbance or riot during this time. The Jews were sitting down and remembering their deliverance from Egypt. And all this was under the more diligent, watchful eye of their Roman overlords at this point. So the tension was great. So they knew they had to be careful there. They didn't want to do something that's going to start a riot. They didn't want to do something, you know, that would cause any problems of that kind. The second goal was they weren't going to just arrest Jesus. They were going to eliminate him. They're going to take him out of the picture. They're going to kill him. There wasn't any. Now, I want to hope we see that. Now, two things about this that are important. This is not all of the chief priest and the elders of the people. This is a select handful of them that are meeting in a particular location, probably the most dominant members. They were also probably members of the Sanhedrin, which was the ruling council of the Jews for most civic affairs that didn't involve Rome. And so they came together, but there's no even pretense of any kind of Old Testament law, what it says, Jewish jurisprudence, their way that they carried out their trials. We got one goal and one goal only. We're going to get him arrested, we're going to do it quietly, and we're going to make sure he's dead. Now, there's several things that we'll look at as we kind of get into this more in more detail over the next couple of chapters, what the steps they had to go through to get to that point. The next time we see this phrase, the chief priests and the elders of the people, will be used when we finally get to an official deliberation of the Sanhedrin. But a lot has happened in between those two. And that's a deliberation where they decide to take this to the Roman authorities. Now, the meeting that Matthew describes, it only involved a few leaders, like I said. I think it's important to talk about a little bit them, about who they were. Caiaphas was the high priest. He had been appointed high priest in 18 AD by the governor at that time, the Roman governor. They appointed the high priest. They weren't allowed to appoint their own high priest. The Jews weren't. The governors had to always put their stamp on it, their approval on it, or have some say in it. But he was a skilled politician. Now, his predecessor was actually his father-in-law, Annas, that's who was high priest before him. But Caiaphas managed to hold on to this position for almost two decades through the rule of the procurator or the prefect Valerius, who was successor to Pontius Pilate, and then all through Pilate's time as well. So he held this position until 36 AD. If you go back and look at the history of the high priests prior to that time, hardly any of them lasted anywhere near that long. So here's an astute politician who is leading this group of people, and their concern above all things is the status quo. We don't want the status quo to be bothered. We don't want to have any change in who's in charge or what's going on. We don't want to do anything that's going to upset our relationship with the Roman government, Roman occupiers. And so that's mostly what they have in line here. And we know from John's gospel that this same Caiaphas then, speaking to this deliberation about how we're going to put this plot together, said, it's better that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. These guys were all about one principle and one principle only of getting things done, and it was that the ends justified the means. We don't care what we have to do. We're going to reach our outcome that we want. Never a good way to go, by the way, from an ethical standpoint. Now, the next event in Matthew's account was placed thematically rather than chronologically. Mark did the same thing. Before we get to it, I just want to comment that what they were writing was in the ancient literature was called a biography, basically. It's a little bit more unique, the gospel form is, but basically it's a biography of somebody. And ancient biographies had some characteristics that were common. One was they didn't care so much about the chronological events in a person's life like we do. We think of a biography of somebody, we don't know the date he was born, the date he went to school, the date he graduated, whatever, all those kinds of things. They didn't care much about that. And they didn't care about the psychology of why they were motivated the way they do because they didn't like their father or whatever, that we all the biographies seem to get through in our time now. What they were concerned with was one thing and one thing only, and it was the character, the virtue of this person, particularly as they approach death. So the model we have in the Gospels is not foreign, is not new to the first century. It's how many biographies were written. And one of the techniques that biographers would use to try to get these kind of set up this, trying to say something about their subject, was to take people around them and see things that they did or said that tell us something about how they valued this person. What kind of value they put on this person. And so what we have Mark and Matthew doing is inserting this next incident. Now, John talks about it as well, which I'll mention here in a minute, but in a place where it follows this plot. So that now we're going to see, okay, we know what these Jewish leaders think of Jesus. Let's see what some other people that are closer to him think of him. And we're going to see this as we get into it in a woman in verse 7 of chapter 26. The disciples we see in verse 8. Judas in verse 15. All offer contrasting examples of what Jesus was worth to them. Now, when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor." If your concern is with strict chronology of all these events, John tells us in his recounting of this that this all took place actually a week before the Passover, before even the triumphal entry. So, but that's not what was important to Matthew and Mark, Matthew in particular. They speak of an unnamed woman. John tells us that that was Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha. They never name her. Just an unnamed woman. They were meeting in the house of Simon the leper. I don't know if they want to buy a house that owned by Simon the leper. But, of course, we wouldn't worry about that. But they did in those days. So I don't know what that meant about that house. But it reminded me of when we first moved to Prosser. Talking to Tim about that earlier this morning. And how we would ask somebody how to get to something or how to find something. And we never got an address. Oh, it's next to so-and-so's old house. Well, this is the original addressing system. Simon the leper's house, okay? We don't know who Simon was, even. He could have been somebody Jesus had healed. That would have been reason to throw a feast for Jesus, or a dinner for Jesus. There's some speculation that maybe he might have been the father of Lazarus. This is a family home that Lazarus and Mary and Martha all lived in. Now, the flask that this woman has is something that was commonly found. In fact, they found tons of these in, tens, hundreds of these in tombs around Jerusalem. They were made of alabaster or some kind of that soft stone. They were carved, and they had a narrow neck on them. I couldn't find a really good picture of one, but all right, I'll put it up here. They were carved out, so you could put something in them, had a narrow neck. Then they would be stored in there, expensive ointments or perfumes, things like that, that were really valuable. I mean, even the process of carving this thing out, the flask itself was valuable. And so they would store these things, and then they would actually seal them, completely seal the tops. So when you wanted to use this stuff, you had to use it all at once. It wasn't putting caps back on it. You'd break the neck of it, and then you would use it. It'd all get used. So, like I said, these are things that have been found. We know they existed. Many of them in tombs where apparently they used these things in part of the dealing with the dead embalming process, that's sort of like what they had back in those days. It's possible that this may have been an heirloom of some kind in Mary's family. It could have been a dowry, possibly. It could have been an inheritance for her. But whatever it was probably the single most valuable thing she owned. Once the flask was opened, like I said, you had to use it or it would spoil or go bad. They didn't have the preservative kind of situation that we do. Matthew reported that she poured it on the head of Jesus, as did Mark. John reports that Mary anointed the feet of Jesus. There would have been plenty for both, is the point that I'm kind of making with that. But most importantly, it was a dramatic and a very costly act of devotion, a personal devotion of this woman, who's unnamed by Matthew, for the person of Jesus. So now it's important for Mark and Matthew's account of this that she's not named, because now she's just a woman, which of course in that society was almost a second-class citizen, someone unimportant. But she does this. But she's the first example of the value that Jesus has for her. The disciples offer the second example. They were indignant. They considered the action a waste. They were motivated by an honorable commitment to the teaching of Jesus to take care of the poor. But they were mostly concerned about what they could have sold this for and how they could have used those funds. What kind of great work we could have done for the Lord. What they represented really was kind of a primary or a focus on the instrumental or the pragmatic aspects of things. They were all about what they could do. They could all about doing things for Jesus. And that's an easy trap to fall into, I think, for any of us. It's always easier to do things than it is to sit quietly and contemplate the nature of our Lord and what he's done for us. That's a hard thing to do. You have to make time for that. It's easier to do. And I think the disciples offer that. Now, they, to a person, except for Judas, of course, which we'll get to here in a minute, would develop the kind of devotion for Jesus that Mary was showing here. But they hadn't yet. They still weren't there. So Jesus corrected them. But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." So we can pat ourselves on the back for being obedient to the words of Jesus this morning. Or remembering. Jesus challenged the disciples' response that this had been something beautiful, something noble, something good that had been done. it was not a waste. He reminded them that you always have the poor with you. And this is one of those verses that gets pulled out of context, and people get hung up on it and say all kinds of things one way or the other about it. But really, it's just an allusion. It's an allusion to Deuteronomy 15:11. And that reads, "For there will never cease to be the poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother and to the needy and to the poor in your land." That's all Jesus was alluding to here. The topic of the poor was not foremost in what Jesus has to say in view of what Mary did, what this woman did. But he made two points. The first one was, you will not always have me. The disciples still seem clueless regarding the predictions of Jesus' death. It's like they didn't want to listen to it. They didn't want to really hear it. We had all those previous predictions, and now Jesus says in 2 days this is going to happen. But still they didn't recognize the idea that he's not always going to be with them. At least not in his current earthly incarnate form at that point. I suspect there was something that the woman, Mary, understood better than his closest disciples. The raising of her brother Lazarus might have something to do with that. May have given her a keener insight into those previous predictions, which all ended and will rise on the third day. But raising to life required death. And so Jesus says, "She has done it to prepare me for burial." Reinforces the thought that she understood the immediate future held for Jesus, which prompted, I think, the statement that wherever this is, gospel is cold, tell this story with it. Here's somebody around me who got it. Maybe one of the first ones, as opposed to those disciples who were committed to Jesus, who were noble in their endeavors, but just not quite there yet. Mary was willing to embrace a hard reality of Jesus' mission that his disciples were not. We're not told anything about the disciples as a group, how they reacted to Jesus' defense of the woman's actions. Matthew simply continued to the third example. There's been a considerable speculation over the centuries about Judas Iscariot, as you can imagine. I imagine all of you, if you've read these stories or heard these stories before, which I think most of you have, you probably wonder about him. What was going on here? And believe me, there's been tons of ink, talking about this. The simple fact is, we really don't have a lot of definitive information about why he did what he did. Especially given the fact that in this culture, to betray your friends or your family was one of the most heinous crimes you could commit. And yet he did it. Some have suggested that his primary interest was revolt against Rome, and as time passed, he became disillusioned with Jesus. He realized that he had no interest in leading a revolt. In this sense, he was kind of confused, like a lot of people were at the time, about what the Messiah was going to be doing or what the purpose of the Messiah was. Some have suggested that knowing Jesus' extraordinary powers, that maybe he thought by putting Jesus in this position where he had to defend himself before the powers that be, that it would precipitate this revolt, would precipitate the kingdom. I'm not sure he was thinking that far ahead or that seriously about it. There's even been an argument made that suggests that Judas should be vindicated to some degree because, he was the one that brought about, bringing about Jesus' sacrifice that was necessary for the forgiveness of sins. The only suggestion or motive we have from the Gospels was John's record that Judas had been the disciple leading the complaint about Mary's waist. And that he also was really not so much concerned with the poor as he was concerned with the fact he was a group treasurer and he used to dip into the till every now and then. Now that's consistent with what Judas' approach to the chief priest was. What will you give me if I betray him? 30 pieces of silver. The Greek text literally says 30 silvers. We don't know what coinage was involved here. So you can't say exactly how much Judas was going to get for betraying his friend. It was reminiscent, though, however, of the same two words in the Greek Old Testament text, the wage paid to a reliable shepherd of God's people in Zechariah 11, which Matthew will quote in the next chapter as being fulfilled here. If we take the assumption or make the assumption that the coin, these were silver coins, and that they were what's called the Tyrian shekel, which was the only one the temple took, the only coinage they would accept. If that's what it was, then what Judas was asking for here worked out to about 120 days' wages. According to John 12, the ointment used to anoint Jesus was valued at 300 days' wages. Matthew's contrast for those people around him and how they value Jesus ranged from this expensive adoration of an unnamed woman in Matthew's account through this disciple sort of pragmatic concern for the teachings of Jesus, but maybe not so much for the person of Jesus, through to the comparatively cheap betrayal by one of those disciples. So it's a classic kind of ancient biography presentation. Luke and John both note the influence of Satan behind the actions of Judas. But the devil made me do it was not and is not a defense for doing evil. God holds all men accountable for their decisions they make. The principle not unrelated, really, to the next part. Now, on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12, and as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him, one after the other, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes, as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" And he said to him, "You have said so." That last comment by Jesus is literally just two words, "You said." You spoke. The Passover was one of the most popular celebrations in the Jewish liturgical calendar. By this time, it had been combined with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they were kind of both treated and often called unleavened bread just by that one term. It recalled, as I mentioned earlier, the leaving Egypt under the leadership of Moses, how God freed them from the Egyptians' slavery of them. There's about a half a dozen views that revolve around reconciling the chronologies of the four Gospels and what we know historically from the period as to whether or not this was a Passover meal that featured the sacrificed lamb or not, what day it was on, all kinds of issues that I'm not even going to get into. If you want to get into that I can recommend some sources, but it's not really worth getting into this morning. The fact is that at this time period in Jewish history, there was not really even a uniform practice involved. What we think of as the Passover, the kind of the uniform practice, didn't come along until a couple centuries later when it was codified in the Mishnah. And right now, there were lots of variations. And in fact, there were even some Jews who did not accept the calendar the temple used. So things were happening all the time at all different times. But regardless of what those things are, we know that for the people, for Jesus, he considered this the Passover meal. So that's going to have a certain set of rituals attached to it that were true in the first century that will be part of this meal. Now, it says, and we're not going to spend much more time on that, but I'm going to start really in where it says, as they were eating. So we see that phrase again here in a minute. As they were eating, Jesus put something of a damper on this celebration. With the announcement that one of the 12 at that meal would betray him. Well, needless to say, the mood became very sorrowful, sad, distressed, all the translations there. And each disciple in turn asked, Lord, is it I? Or I? Is it I, Lord? Am I the one? It doesn't say Jesus answered one way or the other. He answered more generically, in a way that probably didn't comfort them, because the nature of eating a meal in this time period meant it included everybody around the table. They all shared dipping in things. So that didn't help much. But he did make two important statements about his betrayal and his betrayer. About the betrayal, he said, the Son of Man goes as it is written. There were no surprises here. Jesus' betrayal had been prophesied centuries before. He knew that's what was going to happen. The second thing he said was, woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Now, woe is a favorite word for, depending on what translation you have. Look, sometimes it's used, woe. In Matthew, we've seen that several times. The woe to the cities, Chorazin and Bethsaida. Woe to the person who causes someone to sin. Woe to the scribes and the Pharisees. This is the last woe to that one who betrayed him. It's almost as if Jesus put before his betrayer, who was sitting at that table, an accounting for what he was about to do. The seriousness of it. As Matthew recorded it, the last disciple to ask, is it I, was Judas. And he addressed Jesus as Rabbi rather than as Lord, like the rest of them. This exchange with Judas, though, at the end, just these two words that I mentioned, and John makes this clear, presumably was kind of private. No one really knew what it said, but at this point, Judas leaves the meal. And John makes it clear that he left, you know, ostensibly on some errand that he and Jesus knew about. But what really was going on with that last little exchange was, I think, Jesus knew who his betrayer was, and now Judas knew that Jesus knew. Could he have changed his mind? I don't think so, personally. I think he had already gone too far. Now, Luke and John both mentioned Satan's involvement here, but Peter described Satan in his letter, first letter, as a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. I think what Judas became was someone to devour. He'd already made his decision. He'd already committed himself. He may have already taken the money. But the ruler of this fallen world apparently had no real grasp of the certainties of prophecy or the counsels of God that set in motion this plan of redemption that was started before at the foundations of the world. And that really, I want to look at this real quickly here, brings us back to the beginning of Matthew. Or back to the things Jesus already said. In the parables of the kingdom, Jesus said, "This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet, 'I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter what has been hidden since the foundation of the world.'" And then in Matthew 25, that Marty just covered, "Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world.'" God's sovereignty and God and human free will are a mystery. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, it's way above any of our pay grades. If you say you've got that figured out, okay, whatever you say. Two things. God's sovereign purposes required the betrayal of the Savior. Judas freely made a choice for which he would be held accountable. It really comes down to that. "Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, he gave it to his disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' And he took in the cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.'" After that disturbing revelation in the meal that one would betray him, we just figure they resumed eating, resumed the meal, until Jesus interrupted it again. He interrupted it with an unexpected blessing of the food. There would have been a blessing of the food at the beginning, as there was at every meal, really, in a Jewish home or a Jewish setting. At the Passover meal, along with the regular prayer that they would have offered, like something like, "Blessed are you, O Lord, God who brings bread from the earth," they would have added, "This is the bread of affliction our ancestors ate when they came from Egypt." That's one of the differences in the Passover meal. Now Jesus paused the progress of the meal by taking bread and offering another prayer of thanks, breaking it, giving it to disciples, and then saying, "Eat it." Okay, we're in the middle of a meal. We'll eat it. But then adding this idea, "This is my body." That could be a little shocking. Thanks to an incident reported in John's Gospel, though, it wasn't completely shocking. I won't go through all of this in detail, but Jesus fed the 5,000 in John's accounting of it. And after that, the crowds were so, they wanted more bread. And so Jesus had left, and they went looking for him. And he knew that this was what their motivation was. And so he tells them when they come to him, "I am the bread of life." And they didn't know what to make of that. And so we have this little bit in John here. "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." The Jews then disputed among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" So Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever feeds on my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day." Now, as far as we know, Jesus never said anything like this again until this final supper, this final meal together. So it wouldn't have been completely foreign to the disciples, although it was probably really strange to them when they first heard it. I think they see now that there's this huge metaphor that Jesus was building that he really gives some solutions to here. He gets a little more what was involved in all these kind of strange things. John reported that many disciples turned from Jesus after those words. He was interested in who was really interested in following him. But the 12 stayed. Peter spoke for the group, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You're the Holy One of God." Jesus then took this cup. He gave thanks for it, passed it to the disciples, and commanded them to drink of it. By the first century, the Jews had adapted two Greek banquet customs. One was reclining at the table rather than sitting. The other was four cups of red wine that punctuated the meal. And so what the Jews did is they adapted this, and they took those four cups, and they had them, aligned them up, and how they did this, with the promises from Exodus 6. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of this. That was the first promise. I will deliver you from slavery, the second promise. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm, with great acts of judgment. That's the third one. And I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. That's the fourth one. Now Jesus, there's some debate whether this was the third cup or the fourth cup in this meal. Most commentators have it as the third cup, and I think there's some good reason for that. Because of what Jesus said that followed, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. The cup then became the connecting to that I will redeem. How are those sins going to be forgiven? By the redemption, by a sacrifice. When Moses ratified the covenant in Exodus 24, they made the promise, and then he did sacrifices, which was true for the ancient Near East, for any covenant or treaty. And then he did something different by saving part of the blood of sacrifices and then sprinkling it on the people. Now Jesus gives a cup to his disciples, representing this new people, and says, this is my blood given for you. The sacrifice is yet to come. But this is what he was telling them was about. This really goes all the way back to chapter 1, where the angel told Joseph that Mary will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. Of course, Jesus is the Greek form of the Hebrew name Joshua, which means God saved. And then in Matthew 20, when Jesus was actually talking about leadership and using himself as an example of leadership in amongst his people, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, Jesus apparently skipped the fourth cup. I think that's interesting because that would have tied this then to the idea that I will be your God and you will be my people, the final promise. The next verse actually says, having sung a hymn, they left, they went out. We'll get to that next week specifically. Apparently, he skipped the fourth cup of the Passover, told his disciples that he would not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the day when he would drink it with them in the consummation of the kingdom. The ultimate fulfillment of that promise of the fourth Passover cup. When there'll be a permanent sense in which God will make you to be his people and he will be our God. Now, the early church took these words seriously. The Last Supper became a model for their regular gatherings. And the Apostle Paul summarized it. For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way also he took the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the new covenant of my blood. Do this as often as you drink in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Whoever therefore eats the bread and drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of concerning the body and the blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself, and then so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment to himself. If you haven't noticed, we're going to have communion this morning. Whether you call it Eucharist, Lord's Supper, breaking of bread, communion, doesn't really matter very much. It has been crucial or a central part of the worship of Christians for over 2,000 years. That's significant. So to do this, I'm going to get the musical folks back up here. Are any of them here? Some of them are. Okay. Were they planning on playing something during? Yeah. Yeah, okay, all right. So while they're getting here, let me just also add that a thought I've often had about this doing this together as a group, as a fellowship, is that you could take somebody from the first century or the 10th century, didn't really matter, a Christian, a committed Christian, and you could transplant them into this room this morning. They would not understand a word we said, why we're wearing what we're wearing, how we do things, or anything about it. But as soon as we did this little simple exercise of sharing something from bread and something from juice, grape juice or wine, whatever you use, they would have got it. It's that simple. It's that good at connecting us to those who have gone before us.